From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. On today's show, a look at the contentious issues surrounding groundwater policy in Wisconsin's Central Sands region.
Later, how empathetic are Americans in general?
Of course, it's really difficult to measure things like empathy, but all the evidence is showing that we're becoming more and more selfish and individualistic.
Writer Kathleen Ernst's latest mystery tackles some big social issues in addition to murder.
In this book, I really wanted to look at the whole issue of power. Who has power? What will people do to get power? What will people do to hang on to their power? And that can be very broadly defined.
And the Milwaukee Rep takes on the classic story of Harvey in a new production.
Lake Effect is coming your way next after this news update. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. It's good to have you listening today. Water quality and quantity is a pressing issue, even in resource-rich Wisconsin.
Writer Eric Ness focused on a particular region under debate in his November story in Milwaukee Magazine. Ness explores the Central Sands region in Till the Well Runs Dry. The eight-county region boasts 300 lakes and 800 miles of trout streams.
Those natural wonders are sometimes at odds with what has become an agricultural heartland, fed by a massive network of irrigation and wells. Ness tells Lake Effect's Susan Bentz that the complexity of the Central Sands water issues are linked to the region's geological history.
At the end of the last great glaciation, a little lobe of the Green Bay Glacier slipped under and dammed the Wisconsin River. And so as the glacier was melting, you had this ice dam at the other end. And so all of this sand and gravel was washing into this great Wisconsin lake, what they called Glacial Lake Wisconsin, and it settled to the bottom, kind of like a huge sandbox. The gravel and sand is about 100-foot layer on top of the bedrock, and when that dam broke, it carved out what we now know as the Wisconsin River, but it also left behind this big sandbox and sort of laid the table for, you know, a spectacular natural area, but also the groundwater problems that they're facing today.
So agriculture obviously is a big, big operation thanks to irrigation and high-capacity wells.
Yeah, people had tried to make a go of farming in the region for more than 100 years. You know, in a sandy soil, things grow well in it, but you have to water it constantly. After the end of World War II, the aluminum industry had gotten such a boost through wartime production, and they were looking around for businesses, and they realized that, oh, we could make these center point irrigation systems. In 1950, there were fewer than 100 of these wells in the Central Sands region. Now there are more than 3,000, with more going in every year. And so we should talk for a minute about what a high-capacity well is.
Absolutely.
It's defined by the state as one that pumps 100,000 gallons or more of water a day.
And you gave the example, I think, that that's equivalent to what an average family might use in a year?
Mm-hmm. An average family in the United States. I mean,
that's true.
There are many people who get by with a great deal less. But you always have to go back to the geology. There are places, for example, people have heard of the Ogallala Aquifer in Kansas, which is a very deep aquifer that is essentially being mined by farmers in Kansas. So every time they pump water out of the Ogallala Aquifer, there is less of it overall. And there is a definite endpoint where that aquifer will not be able to be used for agriculture anymore. That is not the case in the Sand County region. We have a lot of water in that area. It's a very water-rich area. But again, we get back to the sand. You know, we've all been on a beach, dug a hole, and it fills with water because we found what hydrologists call the water table. Now, as the tide goes out, what happens to that water table? It goes down. And that's essentially the challenge that we face with the lakes and rivers in the Central Sands region, because they sit at the very top of the aquifer there. When we put in 3,000 high-capacity wells, and all of them are pulling, there's still a ton of water left in that aquifer. just not at the surface.
So there's that unique, the uniqueness of that region, and then there's the policy around high-capacity wells that has been evolved and challenged in Wisconsin over the last years. Would you start there with Lake Beulah or before
no,
that?
The most important thing may be to actually talk about the Great Lakes Compact, which...
Excellent.
So the Great Lakes Compact was an attempt by the states to come to some sort of uniform management agreement. It's anticipated that there's going to be lots of pressure in a water-scarce future on this incredible freshwater resources. So at that point in time, the state legislature realized its groundwater laws were woefully inadequate for the kind of management challenges that they were going to be facing in the future, especially under the Great Lakes Compact. And so in 2003 and 2004, the legislature did a sort of first revision of the state's groundwater law. It was passed virtually unanimously.
Bipartisan effort.
Not only was it a bipartisan effort, but there were forums held all over the state, a civil and civic conversation about what water is, how important it is, what we can do to manage it, that played out all over the state. And it was agreed by members of both parties that they were only partway done, that they were going to need to come back and address the issue in a few more years.
This is where Lake Beulah fits in, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There were attempts to write the next generation of groundwater legislation, but they basically stalled. So along comes the Wisconsin Supreme Court in a case about a small lake.
Lake Beulah is located nowhere near the Central Sands. It's in
yes.
southeastern Wisconsin, in the Kettle Moraine.
We don't want to get lost in the weeds
of
this specific decision here. What I think is remarkable about the Lake Beulah decision was the Supreme Court's decision to reiterate Wisconsin's history with respect to water. And it goes all the way back to the Northwest Territories Act, before Wisconsin was even a state. Our legislators in Washington, D.C. were very focused on our ability to travel on rivers because that was the economic lifeblood of the region. And so they inserted this little phrase about, you know, our access to the rivers being forever free. Now, when Wisconsin became a state, our young citizens took that exact phrase and put it in the state constitution. That whole idea of public access to the waterways has been increasingly refined and added to. Again, in 2011, with the Supreme Court decision of Lake Beulah, they reiterated all of this and added to that the observation that groundwater is clearly connected to surface water, and the DNR needs to find a way to take that into account when it issues its rulings on high-capacity wells.
So, Eric, let's circle back. Part of the debate in the Central Sands has been the Little Plover River. It's become sort of a symbol of
right.
the two sides of the story.
Yeah. So I would encourage any listeners who have a browser available to them to go online and type in the words Little Plover River Test Pump. The first result that you'll find is a YouTube video of a 1963 training film produced by the U.S. Geological Survey about the Little Plover River. What's fascinating about it, 1963, so more than 50 years ago, and they're running an experiment where they put a high-capacity well right next to the Little Plover River. They pump an awful lot of water out of it and watch the river go down. And then they stop the pumping and watch the river come back up. Now, the Little Plover River is a tiny river, less than 10 miles long. It has no tributaries. It is also one of the most studied rivers in the United States. It's just such an interesting hydrogeological phenomenon. It's got beautiful sandy bottoms, wonderful trout population. And in 2013, it was listed as one of the 10 most endangered rivers in the United States. But the thing is that we could see all of this coming. You know, the studies that the movie shows were the first round, but in 1971, they released another study where they said, you know, if agricultural pumping keeps going up and we have a drought year, the headwaters of some of these rivers in this region are going to fail. In 1996, when the village of Little Plover put in a new well, new municipal well in the Little Plover River watershed. Scientists at Stevens Point, UW-Stevens Point, ran the numbers, and they said when this well gets to full capacity, the Little Plover River is going to start to run dry. And it did in 2005. And it has run dangerously low almost every year since, which is why it is considered one of the most endangered rivers in America. So you might think that there's no solution for this. You know, we just have to choose the river or choose the water for the people. But we have yet another science project going forward. Ken Bradbury, a UW hydrogeologist, is basically doing the same kind of study that's been done a few times. He laughs at this. He knows he's treading over old ground. But what he is bringing to it is new computer power. And when they are done modeling the Little Plover River, it is conceivable that they're going to be able to help the region optimize its water use.
You also mentioned in the article some farmers are experimenting, that they're looking into new technologies and new information.
Exactly. It's easy to look at farmers in a stereotypical way and just assume they're putting too much water on the field. But what you have to understand about energy costs these days is that just pulling the water from the ground is enormously expensive. And so farmers have every economic reason to try to optimize their water consumption. But I think what we're running up against, again, is this political divide, this inability to talk about the problem. Because that's the thing about this whole optimization strategy. It involves coordinated work by scientists, by farmers, by municipalities, by everyone who's using water. They have to share information. They have to share power. They have to give up the option to throw on the tap on a given day. Like I said, I think it's hard for environmentalists to trust that we're getting there because stalling has been such a big part of the opposition tactics. And I think it's hard for businesses to trust because they figure that there'll always just be another lawsuit around the corner.
Eric Ness's article on water issues in the Central Sands region of Wisconsin is in the November issue of Milwaukee Magazine. He spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz, and there is a link to the interview from WUWM.com/lakeeffect.
We live in an era of Facebook likes and Twitter favorites, but are we any more concerned about others than we ever were before? We'll talk about the present and future of empathy when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Empathy is one of those values that we're taught as children. It's the idea of imagining yourself in someone else's shoes and using that sense as a guide for how to treat other people.
But as we get older, empathy is sometimes easier said than done. In the end, what difference does empathy make in the grand scheme of things? And how can we reconnect with it? Writer Roman Krasnarek sets out to explore the concept of empathy in a new book called Empathy, Why It Matters, and How to Get It.
He talked with Lake Effect's Dan Harmon about where he sees empathy reflected in society today.
I'm sorry to say that empathy in America is in free fall. There's great evidence showing that empathy levels have dropped by about 50% in the last three decades, the steepest decline in the last 10 years. And at the same time, we're seeing a rise in narcissism and online abuse, particularly in the digital world. And of course, it's really difficult to measure things like empathy, but all the evidence is showing that we're becoming more and more selfish and individualistic.
I've read an article called Facebook is for Middle-Aged Narcissists, which I think was quite amusing. Do you think that these things are tied together, the rise of narcissism and self-interest and then the decrease in empathy? Why can't they coexist, if so?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's several studies showing that the more Facebook interactions you have, the more narcissistic you're likely to be. And it's a sorry state of affairs, really, but a lot of people are using social media as a way of shoring up themselves. That people are constantly updating and perfecting their online profiles. But you would think that actually digital technology would have great potential because it's an opportunity to try and connect with people from different cultures in different countries. You know, 2.7 billion people are on the internet. But unfortunately, we still haven't become very good at using technology to make emotional connections. You know, how many of us can really talk about our deepest feelings very well in 140 characters of a Twitter tweet? You need to be a Japanese haiku poet to be able to do that pretty well.
Oh, that's another lost art right there. Okay. Given that you could say that Facebook or just, you know, we're picking on Facebook, but just having an online presence is narcissistic. But the other side of that would be, well, someone's got to be reading it. So you would think that people that are looking at other people's profiles or all these stories that are now available to us or whatever it is online, that we would be developing more empathy as a result of what's available to us on the internet. So why has that not happened, do you think?
I think probably because most social networking apps are designed for the efficient exchange of information rather than intimacy. And certain things like Facebook can be ways of connecting with people in a deep emotional way, but it tends to be other technologies which can help us do it. So, for example, there's a wonderful program which creates Skype conversations between teenagers in Brazil who are trying to learn English and retirees in care homes in Chicago who are lonely and have got nothing to do. And the Chicago retirees teach English to the young Brazilians using Skype and other video technologies. And they not only learn English, they create empathic bonds and they challenge their prejudices about each other's lives. And I think that's a great use of technology. There just isn't as much of that going on as there could be. And I'd like to see there be many more empathy-based video games and apps which connect us not just with people who are like us, but people who are different from us.
You mentioned earlier that you said empathy is on the decline in America. Is there anywhere in the world where it's doing well or on the rise?
That's a really interesting question. And I'm not sure I know the answer to that, but I do know that in certain countries have very high levels of empathy and they've been constant. So countries like the Netherlands and Norway, we haven't seen large declines. But in the United States, in Britain, in Australia, many countries, you've seen empathy really plummeting. And, you know, I think there are things we can do about it. I mean, in Canada, for example, they've started a fantastic empathy teaching program in schools called Roots of Empathy. And the way it works is fantastic, is they bring a baby, a real-life baby, into the classroom, and the kids adopt the baby for the year. And they sit around the baby and they start talking about the baby. Why is the baby crying? Why is the baby laughing? What's she thinking or feeling? Basically, they're trying to step into the baby's shoes, empathizing. And this program, which over 500,000 kids around the world have now done, called Roots of Empathy, increases empathy levels, increases cooperation, decreases bullying, and even increases general academic attainment. So even if empathy is in decline, I think there really is something we could do about it.
It seems also that there's nowhere where it's more on display, this lack of empathy, than politics or the way that we all talk about politics or we talk about other politicians that we don't like. So it just seems, and then of course the people that support those politicians we don't like, of course we don't like them. So it just seems like it's devolved into this us against them thing in which it's almost impossible to have empathy or even cooperation.
Absolutely. I think that political partisanship is something that really kills empathy, of course, because you only care about people who've got the same views or the same political position as you do. And so there's a lot of toxic us versus them conflict, which is the opposite of empathy in politics. On the other hand, you can look around the world and see incredibly inspiring examples of empathy building in the most difficult political situations. I mean, just for example, in Israel and Palestine, there's this extraordinary organization called the Parents Circle, which brings together Palestinians and Israelis who all have something in common, which is they've all had a family member killed in the conflict. And they bring them together for conversations and story sharing, but they also run public programs. My favorite one they did was called the Hello Peace telephone line, and there was a free phone telephone number on billboards around the country, and any Israeli could call it, and they were put through on the phone line to a Palestinian stranger who they could talk to about absolutely anything for up to half an hour. Palestinians could call a number and put through to Israelis. And it's in its first 5 years of operation, over 1 million phone calls were made on the Hello Peace phone line. And just imagine if we could do that today using phone lines or online video technologies to get rich investment bankers to talk to people who've had their homes repossessed, getting politicians to actually talk to their constituents. I think we'd have an empathic revolution on our hands.
Wow. I mean, when you were describing it, I'm thinking, wow, how easy, however, it would be for it to devolve into a blame session or some other kind of heated conversation. How does it not escalate? How do they keep it?
Sometimes it does.
Okay.
Sometimes in those Israeli and Palestinian conversations, sometimes they are arguing with each other like crazy. But in general, it tends to create a bit more understanding than you started with at the beginning and often creates friendships. In one famous example, this Israeli man started shouting at this Palestinian guy down the phone. And then by the end of it, He'd agreed to meet with a Palestinian and then regularly went to give insulin and other medicines at the border posts to this Palestinian family because they couldn't get any of these medical equipment in the refugee camps. So I think there's always hope. And there's a great piece of research in psychology. It's called contact theory. And basically the idea is if you bring together people from different backgrounds, whether it's black and white or Israelis and Palestinians, and you bring them together for conversations in conditions of rough equality, in 94% of cases, you create more empathy and understanding and challenge stereotypes and prejudices. So yes, it's true, sometimes you bring people together and they'll fight like cats and dogs.
Right.
But actually, in general, people start seeing each other as human beings.
How closely is this decline or lack of empathy related to the feeling of being powerless? I mean, we could talk about endless numbers of examples in that regard, even just from, you know, not giving money to a homeless person because you think, well, good is it going to do to, you know, international type issues. So are those tied together?
Yeah, I think there's lots of reasons for the decline of empathy. I think partly there's a sense of, is my action going to make any difference? And I think there have been times where people kind of think that it could make a difference. I mean, after the Second World War, there was a massive rise of humanitarian aid giving to developing countries coming out of Europe and the United States. It was an extraordinary shift. Now, today, there's a bit of a backlash against that, and it tends to go in waves. But we still tend to be very responsive to images and pictures and personal stories. The great problem, I think, is that a lot of what the media has done is anesthetize us to other people's suffering. So people often talk about what's called compassion fatigue or empathy fatigue. You know, you've seen so many pictures or photographs of children starving in sub-Saharan Africa, or in the end, you just kind of turn off. So I think organizations who are working in these issues have to keep sparking our empathic brains so that we keep responding and we're not just subject to fatigue. But it is an issue, and that sense of powerlessness that you mention is something that's there. And that's why I'm quite an advocate of trying to practice empathy in everyday life, even like having curiosity about strangers in the world around you. Have a conversation with a stranger once a week, whether it's the heavily tattooed woman who delivers your post or the quiet guy in the office who always eats lunch alone. And having those conversations where you get beyond superficial talk is good for our empathic health because it's the beginning of challenging stereotypes and prejudices, which help, in a way, build a more empathic world one conversation at a time.
I'm still intrigued by the idea that Americans view ourselves, I think, as giving. And, you know, that's statistically, I think it's true in a way that we give a lot of money to charities. But at the same time, there's this decline of empathy. What do you think? Where is that disconnect?
I think that there's different ways of giving. You can give to someone because you feel sorry for them, which is what psychologists call sympathy. You know, it's, you don't really try and step into somebody else's shoes and understand their perspective. And then, of course, there's giving from that more empathic position where you really put yourself in their position. And that tends to motivate you to, you know, not just give money, but also give time. So it is really interesting that there's still a giving culture in many ways, but there's this decline of empathy. And I think part of the explanation, you can see it through how different generations are responding. So you might see there tends to be the great increase in narcissism and fall in empathy tends to be amongst younger people, college students, for example. And it may well be that the giving is still going on from older generations. But in time, we may well see the giving decline as well. And I wouldn't be surprised if that happened.
Does anything else give you reason for hope that we can move in the other direction from narcissism to more empathetic listening?
I think the great hope actually lies in the new science of empathy, which is that for the last couple of hundred years, we've basically been told by our cultures that we are selfish and individualistic, narcissistic creatures. But alongside our selfish inner drives, which surely exist, of course, modern neuroscience tells us that we are wired for empathy. You know, 98% of us have the ability to step into other people's shoes, wired into our brains. And I think that is a great hope for us. We are, you know, what one might call homo empathicus. And we can nurture this empathy. We need to teach empathy in schools. We need to give empathy tests for job recruitment so we fill organizations with more emotionally intelligent and empathic beings. And I think we need to support organizations which are trying to create empathy on a mass scale, like that parent circle organization I mentioned that
made that Hello Peace telephone line in Israel and Palestine. And I think those are all ways we can start using empathy or harnessing its power so it can change our lives from the personal level to the political level.
Well, Roman Krasnarek, thank you so much for coming on our program.
Thanks very much for having me on. It'd be great to talk to you.
Roman Krasnarek's book is called Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. He's a founding faculty member of the School of Life in London and advisor to organizations such as Oxfam and the United Nations.
He's currently at work on his latest project, founding the Turing Empathy Museum, which he plans to launch next year.
Another quick break, and then we'll chat with Wisconsin author Kathleen Ernst about the latest in her series of mysteries featuring a sleuth whose day job is curating history at Old World, Wisconsin. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Chloe Ellefson encounters more mayhem than you might imagine for a curator at Old World, Wisconsin. Fortunately for all of us, Chloe is a fictional character, and the murders she helps unravel are also of a fictitious nature.
The latest installment in the series, featuring Chloe and her love interest, the police officer Relke McKenna, is called Tradition of Deceit. It finds Chloe working on a murder in Minneapolis while Relke is trying to solve a grisly crime in Milwaukee.
There's also a third plot underlying the book playing out in the Midwest a century ago. Kathleen Ernst will talk about the book tonight in Milwaukee, but she's with us in the studio right now. Welcome back to the show.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Which came first for you in writing this book? Was it your interest in the Polish immigrant story in the Midwest, or the kind of milling history you tell, or was it the murders?
Can I say none of the above? What I always start by thinking about is where my characters are at the beginning of a book, and how are they going to grow and change emotionally over the course of the book, and where I see them by the end of the book. And then I look for stories that will help reflect that. So in Tradition of Deceit, I knew I wanted to present some challenges for Chloe and Relke, my two main characters, and I knew I did want to focus on a new to the series ethnic group, which is Polish culture. And I also really like the idea of having an urban story, because most of what I've done in the past has looked at rural communities. So everything sort of came together from there.
There's a certain grittiness in this novel that isn't necessarily as present in your previous work. And in the case of the part that plays out in Minnesota, kind of a literal grittiness.
Yes, absolutely. Chloe is in Minneapolis, and she is helping a friend who's in the process of considering how to turn an abandoned flour mill into a museum. And at the time, the mill has been abandoned for many years. There's lots of equipment. It's really a huge hulk and ruin. So there is literal grittiness there. It was a fabulous situation to set a mystery in. Then in the Milwaukee portion of the book, Relke is in Milwaukee investigating the murder of a friend. And there is a little bit more of an edge to this book. His best friend was murdered while on duty as a police officer. It's not an overtly violent book in any way, but it is certainly a little edgier than the books that I've done in the past.
And darker, too,
and
I would
a little
say.
Darker, yes. It has to do with loss of a very personal friend for Relke, so that's very personal. And it also explores the whole issue of, as these two people, Chloe and Relke, are learning how to be a couple, what does that mean? And for each of them, they discover that people that they're very close to have been keeping secrets, and that presents some real emotional challenges for them.
I think one of the significant developments in this book that you allude to is that it does feature both Chloe and Relke, but they are apart for nearly the entire book.
They are, and that presents a challenge for the two of them. And Relke is also a very he can be a very hard-focused guy. And when he discovers that, first, his friend has been killed, and then second, there's some allegations that perhaps his friend was drinking on duty, and he starts getting concerned that maybe the investigation is not going to proceed as it should, he charges to Milwaukee, and he is heads down doing what he feels he needs to do. And that really leaves no room for Chloe, right when she feels that she should be there for him and be a support for him. So that gives her sort of the green light to go to Minneapolis and help this friend who's having a problem. But they are apart. It presents some real challenges for their relationship, and they have to, both of them, really think about, what am I bringing to this relationship? What am I comfortable with? And how much am I going to share with this person?
Let's shift back to Minneapolis for a bit. Talk about who's murdered in that scenario. This is a murder that actually takes place in this abandoned flour mill.
That's right. The murder victim is a professor. And I'm looking at the period in the early 1980s, which is the time that the Minnesota Historical Society and the city were trying to figure out, what are we going to do with this huge, hulking ruin? A lot of people who didn't have homes were finding shelter there, and then a lot of kids who were just looking for a place to run around and get into trouble were sneaking in. And the professor was one of the people who really felt passionate about this building, that it deserved to be preserved, and that the stories needed to be told. So on Chloe's first visit to the mill, unfortunately, they find the body of the professor hidden in some milling equipment.
As we said, you have three simultaneous plots running through the book. Talk about what was going on before the turn of the 20th century and shortly after. We're learning about the Polish immigrant community in the Midwest.
Yes, because I have such a strong interest in history and talking about immigrants, although usually to rural areas, I was really fascinated to discover what I could about some of the earliest workers in the mill district in Minneapolis. And for a lot of people, including Polish immigrants who arrived really with nothing, they moved into a community called Bohemian Flats, which is just down the river from the milling district. And it was a very close-knit community, even though there was a lot of diversity. And people started trudging up the hill and going to work in the mills. It was a very hard job in the 1870s, 1880s, a lot of very physical labor. And, of course, at first it was all men. And I'm looking at an extended family, a Polish family, four generations of women. And because no mill jobs were available when the Magdalena, my first immigrant, arrives, she was running a boarding house. And then in time, her granddaughter gets one of the first milling jobs for women during the war.
And works in a part of the mill referred to as no man's land.
No man's land, yes. That was a very special place for them, and it literally was no man's land. They had a lounge with a piano, and it was a place where they could gather. It was very hard work. They were filling sacks of flour, 5-pound sacks, and they really had a quota that they had to meet. But it was also a place where women, I think, could feel empowered, because for the first time they were earning money. And they had this place where they could spend time with other workers and make friends. And I think for most of them it was a really positive experience.
Well, what was the central tension in the lives of these immigrants that you were trying to capture in telling this part of the story?
As time went on, there was a lot of tension within the mill, as certain mill workers try to work with management to create better working conditions. Initially, they were working very long days, and especially for the men who were hauling barrels of flour and loading train cars, it was just grueling labor. And in the early years, before people understood about the safety concerns with flour dust in the air, there was actually something called Miller's Lung. And the early workers said that there were days in the mill where there was so much flour dust in the air, if you held your arm out, you couldn't see your hand at the end because of all the haze. So there was definitely some conflict over the years as labor worked with management to try to get better working conditions.
How much time do you have to spend in places like Milwaukee and Minneapolis to feel like you can credibly portray these, you know, not just the modern day story that Relke's involved in, but the historical ones as well?
I spend a lot of time. I cast a very wide net as a researcher, and I spend a lot of time learning and thinking before I ever start to write any of the books. And I feel very strongly about having a good sense of place. As a reader, I enjoy books with a strong sense of place, and I want to instill that in the Chloe Ellefson mysteries as well. So I do spend a lot of time. I spend a lot of time in both areas and learned also as much as I could from written resources, diaries that might be left. And I was lucky enough to work with experts also in both cities. The Minneapolis Historical or the Minnesota Historical Society staff was fabulous. And in Milwaukee, I worked with people at the Old Southside Settlement Museum who were kind enough to give my husband and I a private tour of their marvelous museum and talk with me and in both cases reviewed the manuscript for me. And that, I hope, all that sort of sifts into the novel. Even though everything I learned can't make it into the novel, I hope it instills a good sense of reality for the reader.
One of the things I noticed, though, in comparison to previous Chloe books, there are far fewer sort of traditional crafts and tools that make appearances in this book, though we should say there's a lot of traditional Polish food that appears.
There's a lot of traditional Polish food, and also I did go in a slightly different direction. I wanted to focus a little bit on a Polish folk art, and I chose something called wicinanki, which is paper cutting. And
I'm glad you pronounced that for me.
Yes, that's as I understand, that's what my Polish friends tell me. It's a vibrant, beautiful art. And that also provides a bit of a link between what's going on in Minneapolis and what's going on in Milwaukee.
And this is a tricky subject to get into because I think as people read the book, they'll discover what's going on here. But you also delve into some real social issues that have carried on from, you know, for a long time and in this case from the early 20th century through the present day.
This book is full of that in a single issue. It talks about the plight of homeless people in our urban areas. What do they do if they have no other alternative, and who is going to help take care of them? And then in a broader sense, in this book, I really wanted to look at the whole issue of power. Who has power? What will people do to get power? What will people do to hang on to their power? And that can be very broadly defined. It might be a professional relationship. It might be a personal relationship. But those struggles are really at the heart of both of the murders. And especially for women, that resonates both in the historical timeline and then in both of the modern day timelines. What happens when women have to confront someone who has more power than they do, and sometimes that person might be abusing their power.
Is there another Chloe novel in the works already?
There is. I'm delighted to say that I'm almost finished working on the next Chloe novel, which will be out next fall. And it's a little too early to talk about that, but I'm excited about it. And then I'm under contract for one more after that.
Kathleen Ernst, thank you so much. Congratulations on the new book.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
The latest novel by Kathleen Ernst is called Tradition of Deceit. It's the fifth in a series of mysteries featuring Chloe Ellefson.
Ernst is also the author of numerous historical novels for the American Girl series for children. She lives in Middleton, but she'll talk about the book this evening at an event at Boswell Book Company.
Coming up next, we'll catch up with three longtime Milwaukee Rep actors reunited on stage in the play Harvey. Stay tuned. Lake Effect will be right back.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. When actors Jonathan Daly, Jim Pickering, and Richard Halverson came to the studio to talk with us about the Milwaukee Rep's production of Harvey, we knew we were in for a lot of fun, and we weren't disappointed.
Harvey, the play by Mary Chase, opened in 1940. The famous movie based on that play starred Jimmy Stewart and came out in 1950. Daly takes on the role Stewart made famous, Elwood P. Dowd, he of the 6.5-foot invisible rabbit friend named Harvey.
Pickering plays Dr. William Chumley, and Halverson is Judge Omar Gaffney. All three of them join me in the studio now. Gentlemen, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
And what a great play to get you all together. And Jim, you were saying just before we turned on the microphone, there's something, how many, 140 years
yes,
of combined?
Yes, we reckoned it up among the three of us, Jonathan, Gillard Daly, and Richard Halverson, and me. 135 years of professional experience.
And I'm only 39 years old.
Which means that John and I are really old.
Yeah.
When you think about that and how theater has changed and not changed in that time and how the profession has changed and not changed.
Yeah, we all grew up in the regional theater where we, I think,
we spent time in resident companies 7, 8 years at a time and then go to another one. And that was kind of the way of the world for an actor. But that's very different now. Now it's really a go event to event, show to show.
Richard mm-hmm. practically set a record in Cleveland and then he like broke his own record in Milwaukee.
for numbers of
well,
years.
Many times somebody would say, well, don't you want to go to New York? Don't you? Well, the resident theater satisfied me. I did like 6-8 plays a year, which you don't do in New York. And you're part of the community and you live there. So it was fine for me.
It combined that really wonderful – the gypsiness of being a professional performer, but also gave you that stability, you know, of being able to be part of a community and being
yes.
able to, you know, go to
yes.
the grocery store and know the people mm-hmm. who are your neighbors and that sort of thing.
We're fortunate in Milwaukee because now, unlike when I first came here back in the late Cenozoic era, there are so many theaters at which we all work now. Besides the Milwaukee Rep, which along with Theater X were the only two theaters in town. Now there's a plethora of
yeah.
them.
Professional companies and doing good work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
yeah.
Which is great because you have a night off or a week off. You can go see other things and thoroughly enjoy them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is great.
That's amazing how much really good theater there is in this town.
Yeah. This fall has been especially good, I thought.
Yeah. yeah, I think so too. And I love the – a lot of people don't realize that, you know, if you're in a show, you're not going to go see. You can't see anything else, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
dark night is Monday night traditionally and everybody's dark. So mm-hmm. it's not like you can go and see something on, yeah. on your night off.
That's the night you stay home and put your feet up.
Yes, and rest your voice and all of that. But you can't rest your voices right now because you have to tell me about Harvey. And you have to
okay.
tell me about being on stage together.
Mm-hmm.
Have you all three been on stage together in things before?
Oh, a number of times.
Yes,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yes
yeah.
we have. Well, the first play I ever did at Milwaukee Rep was with Jim Pickering and Laura Gordon. I worked with Deb Staples. She was a student of mine about 30 years ago. Richard, I've known for 20 years.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
yeah.
You go into this rehearsal hall and it is just – it is old home week.
Mm-hmm.
Lori Birmingham is in the play. Mm-hmm. We've all worked with her for years. I mean,
yeah.
it's just great.
I haven't worked at the Rep for about 3 years. The last thing I did there was the Cherry Orchard. And so it's great to be back in a theater that you like, working with friends – and in a good script with a good director. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah, you know, really, the combination of that that's been going on with Harvey has really been mm-hmm. wonderful.
And our new friends that are in the cast are
yes.
just great to work with.
The new generation.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There are some younger people in the cast.
Oh, yeah.
And there's one fellow who's just graduated, right? Am I forgetting?
Oh, yeah, Chris, Chris O'Reilly.
Chris O'Reilly,
yeah.
yes.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So he's, you know, he's fresh onto the boards.
mm-hmm. And he's a big guy, so he has been our occasional stand-in for an imaginary rabbit, which is one
yes.
of the things that the play is about.
Yeah, every now and then you got to get a real live body in there so you can kind of figure out, oh, when he sits at this chair, his head goes to up about here. Otherwise, you're looking at his belly button all day. So
right. Yeah. Yeah. Right, and that helps you because, of course, Harvey mm-hmm. is your friend.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes. You are Elwood.
Yeah. We've had so much fun rehearsing that occasionally our director, KJ Sanchez, wants to be Harvey.
Yeah.
Of course, she's about a foot and a half shorter than Chris,
yeah,
so it's
yeah.
an entirely different thing. We've discouraged her from doing that.
From doing that, yeah. Yeah, well, being part of the club.
It's mm-hmm. a great script, and this is the third time I've been in it. The first time was back in the 50s, and I saw the first professional tour from Broadway that had a couple of the original actors in it. And so that summer, when I was in my mid-20s, I was asked to play Elwood. And so I remembered what Frank Fay did and tried to do what he did. And, of course, you can't do that. And so I was just so-so. But then a few years ago, I played the judge again and realized what a darn good play this is.
Now, did the play come before the movie or did the movie come first and the play come from
there? The play came first.
Yeah. Okay. So and the movie was adapted.
Yeah. yeah Jimmy that. Stewart was not the original Elwood P. Dowd.
No, Frank Fay was. Yeah. And he was a song and dance man.
However, I'm doing the Rep and Depth for the show and I've discovered that owing to a promise made to a producer during the last year of the run of the show on Broadway, and it ran for 5 years on Broadway, Jimmy Stewart played Elwood P. Dowd for a period of about 6 months in the Broadway production.
But he was not the original.
No.
Yeah. Okay.
He was busy. In 1944, Jimmy was busy shooting down airplanes for the United States Army
right.
Air Force.
Was this the first part after he did his service?
To tell you the truth, I don't know. I think it probably
actually,
was
I think,
the first
I think
Broadway
It's a Wonderful
part.
Life was one of the first things he did after
that.
Back.
Okay. Okay.
But
yeah.
on stage, it might have been this.
It might have been the first thing.
And he did it for years, too. I mean, he was doing it when he was in his 70s. Because there were occasional revivals of the play. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he became so identified with the role that he loved doing it as often as he could.
Well, it is such a wonderful feel-good script. But it's also something that it could easily go to sentimentality, but it doesn't.
It doesn't. And that's the genius of Mary Chase writing this particular play. This play is sneaky, sardonic. It's sneaky, ironic. It's the wit is brilliant. The jokes are great, and the characters she's drawn are just so wonderfully specific and so much fun to play that you know you just let her tell this story, and it's so much richer than you would think at first glance. Mm-hmm. That's why I think one of the reasons why I think it's endured. It is one of those plays where you can say they don't write them like that anymore because it
that's
is constructed
true.
Like a brick structure. If you know what I mean.
I do.
It's really well put together. So if you behave yourself, you behave yourself and tell the story, Miss Mary Chase takes care of you.
The well-made play. That's what it is.
It truly is.
And it's wonderfully subversive. It's really quietly subversive. Elwood is, and so is the play itself. The message is just really, really interesting that it takes on the status quo in very quiet ways.
It punctures the pretenses of sort of upper middle class society. It does a number on the medical profession as well.
Yes, it does.
Psychiatrists do not fare well, I think, in this play. Although everything winds up in a wonderful situation towards the end.
That's the part that fascinates me is that, as you say, Richard, it's a well-made play and things end up well. And that could have so easily gone into just being trite. You know that, it all wraps up and everything's nice, but it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
It
mm-hmm.
does. She somehow manages to not go to that, you know, everything's happy and treacly.
Right.
It
does wrap up, but in such a gentle, marvelous way that you wonder, well, is the curtain going to fall now or is it going to fall later, you know?
Yes, it has to do with, the value of illusions, really, and what they mean. And, that's the relationship of Elwood P. Dowd to Harvey is a very rich one.
It is. Yeah. It is. Yeah. And when you're in a rehearsal of this play, it is virtually impossible not to get into the mindset that Elwood lives in, which is this deep contentment and appreciation for other people and for connecting with people. That's the thing that's his amazing gift is that he really cares about people and he wants to know everything he can about the people that he encounters every moment. He lives in the moment and he really appreciates people. And that's just a great thing to walk into work every day and do that for a living.
And what did his mother tell him about being smart?
Oh yeah, well there's you can be smart, you can go through your life being smart, or you can go through your life being pleasant. And Elwood spent a lot of time in his early life being smart, and he's decided that pleasant really is a much better way to be.
But do you think then that Harvey has made him this wonderful man he is? And he was a nice guy before, but now his friendship with Harvey has enriched his view of people.
Yeah. Harvey's kind of an angel. Harvey is he's referred to as a puka, which is a very ancient concept that Mary Chase borrowed that has to do with a real being that comes and visits very lucky people and can help them and guide them through life. And that's really what Harvey is about.
And one of the wonderful things about Elwood is he has this puka and he's so eager to share the experience of Harvey with other people.
Yeah.
It's funny how Harvey begins the play being invisible to everyone but Elwood. But by the end of the play, that is not the case. And the way that happens is really fun in this play, I think.
Yeah, it's not like the Mr. Ed
myth, mm-hmm. you know, that, mm-hmm. that you know, Wilbur only talks to it's not that at all. The, Harvey really does exist. It's just the people who are able to see him and figure out how to see him, they're the lucky people.
Yeah. Yeah, I the judge say at one point, well, he's had that rabbit in my office many times.
Right.
Yeah. So he's touched everybody's life.
Well, I love the message of being in the moment. We hear that a lot now. That seems to be sort of a modern mantra of, you know, you're going to be in the moment. But people who really are make other people uncomfortable. And I think this play works through that as well to kind of say, you know, you have to kind of accept some things mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. do this.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's one of the things that happens throughout the play is the number of rules of society, of medicine, of human relationships that get punctured and violated in a very wonderful way by the situation yeah. of this guy having a 6.5-foot rabbit to talk to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people just kind of reveal their foolishness simply by – it's not really anything they say. It's just that Harvey or Elwood, through Harvey, gives them opportunity to kind of – reveal their ignorance and reveal their narrow-mindedness. He doesn't have to say anything. All he's got to do is let them open their mouths and they show you who they are.
But again, it's done in a gentle way and there's redemption allowed. You know, am I wrong with that?
No, not at all. Not at all. People do come to realizations about themselves that they wouldn't have had otherwise. That's almost always a good thing.
Yeah, and nobody gets his comeuppance in this play.
Right. It's not like you're getting slapped around right. for this. It's like, oh, we all have shortcomings and we all have blind spots. And what I've always thought of this work as is a way to kind of come to grips with that and also forgive yourself mm-hmm, for it mm-hmm. and then move forward.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which leads to contentment, at least I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And contentment is something that is – the thing that's interesting to me about Elwood is that – he has chosen this path of contentment. It's not that he's just kind of some simple-minded fellow who just kind of lives in the moment. He really has chosen this as a way to survive in a very difficult world. I mean, this play was written in the middle of World War II. So this play responds to a world that is in chaos. And, of course – our world is not any less chaotic than it was in 1940. Oh, yeah. So I think it's a really important thing to say to people that you have to really work hard to pursue contentment when everything in society tells you otherwise.
Well, gentlemen, always a pleasure to have you in the studio. I cannot wait to see you all on stage in this. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Brian.
Great to be here. Always love it.
Jonathan Daly, Jim Pickering, and Richard Halverson are all in the Milwaukee Reps production of Harvey, which is in previews right now. The official opening night is this Friday, and the production will run through December 21st. There's more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect.
That's all for the Wednesday edition of the program. Hope you enjoyed it. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in.
And I'm Bonnie North. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air comes your way next.